This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In the early days of Barack Obama's first presidential campaign, he gave a speech at a gala for an organization called Kids in Distressed Situations. At the time, U.S. politics were focused largely on the federal deficit, but he wanted to turn the conversation to a different kind of shortage.
If we hope to meet the moral test of our times, if we hope to eradicate child poverty or AIDS or joblessness or homelessness or any of the other issues that were chronicled before I came on stage, then I think that we're going to have to talk more about the empathy deficit, the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes, to see the world through somebody else's eyes.
A recent study out of the University of Michigan reveals that empathy, the ability to figuratively put one's self in the shoes of another, has been on the decline since the 1980s, with the steepest drop occurring just in the past 10 years. So what's the cause of this drop-off in empathy, and what can we do to reverse the trend? Roman Krznarek is a writer, philosopher, and founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. His latest book is Empathy: Why It Matters and How to Get It. Roman, welcome back to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
The vast majority of human beings, you write, 98%, are born to empathize and wired for social connection. So what exactly is the purpose of empathy? What is the, I guess, evolutionary advantage?
Well, it is extraordinary that over the last 300 years, we've been basically told by our culture that we're self-interested creatures.
Right.
But neuroscience research in the last 10, 20 years has told us that we are wired for empathy and social cooperation. As you said, you know, 98% of us have the ability to step into other people's shoes and look through their eyes. And it's an evolutionary adaptation, according to primatologists and evolutionary biologists. Just think that as groups, human beings had to survive and cooperate together in order to protect themselves from predators, in order to share food in times of scarcity. They required empathy, that ability to understand other people's feelings and needs. And just think of a parent with their child. You know, anybody who's had a baby, you know, will respond to their baby's cry. It's a way of keeping us surviving, you know, as a species. So empathy is deeply built into our mammalian self.
And that 2%, the folks that can't feel empathy, I guess that's what divides what we consider normal folks from psychopaths.
That's right. Amongst those 2% are the psychopaths or sociopaths who find it very difficult to not only step into other people's shoes, but to really feel other people's feelings. Because when it comes down to it, if you look in a psychology textbook, there's two kinds of empathy. There's one kind called affective empathy. That's where you feel what other people feel. So if you see anguish on a child's face and you too feel anguish, that's affective empathy. And then there's what's called cognitive or perspective-taking empathy, where you really try to imagine what's it like to be another person. You know, to be a homeless guy sleeping out on a cold winter's night, what's it like to be walked past by people without even looking you in the eye? And this affective and cognitive empathy, most of us have both of them, though there's a tiny percentage that don't.
Now, tell me a little bit, because when I was younger, I often grappled with the distinction between sympathy and empathy. Can maybe you just explain a little bit what separates the two?
I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of confusion about it. You know, if you look on an anguished child's face and you feel, as I said, the same emotion as them, like you feel anguish too, that's what's called empathy, particularly affective empathy. But if you look on that child's face and you feel a different emotion, for example, pity, or you feel sorry for them, you think, oh, the poor little thing, that's what's called sympathy. Sympathy is an emotional response, but one that isn't shared. And actually, sometimes sympathy just isn't enough. You can feel sorry for someone, but not actually know what they really need. And if you think about my children, if I think about them, I've got twins, a boy and a girl. And when they're about 1.5, before their empathy had kicked in, they could actually sympathize. So when my son was crying, his sister would try and comfort him with her favorite toy dog, which was a kind and sympathetic gesture, but not a lot of use to him. Fast forward a year, when they're about 2.5 and the empathy had kicked in, when my son was crying, his sister would try and comfort him with his favorite toy cat. That's the imaginative leap of empathy, really understanding somebody else's perspective.
So you've talked about empathy being on the decline worldwide, and especially in the U.S. So what does a world without empathy look like? What is at stake here?
What does a world without empathy look like? It looks like Germany in the 1930s and early 1940s.
Okay, that's not good.
That isn't good. You know, the Nazis were brilliant at eroding empathy for Jews, homosexuals, for gypsies, Roma people. They took away their humanity, so people didn't see them as individual human beings. When you erode empathy, you can treat somebody as a non-person. Famously, there was a philosopher called Martin Buber who made this distinction between an I-thou relationship and an I-it relationship. A bit tricky to understand, but what he meant was that when you treat someone as an equal and you treat them as a full human being, you step into their shoes, look through their eyes, that's what he called an I-thou relationship. And an I-it one is when you treat someone as an object, not really as a full human being. And in Nazi Germany or segregation in the United States, for much of the 20th century, people were treated as its.
While reading your book, it's hard not to look at the state of empathy in decline and connect it maybe to the state of narcissism, which seems to be seeing an opposite upward trend. And a lot of people connect the narcissism that we're seeing to social media. So is this a case where you're looking at empathy and you're saying social media, we're talking about Facebook, Twitter, are these the things that are driving this downward trend for empathy?
It certainly looks like that social media is a major factor in eroding our empathic capacities and sending empathy in America into free fall. We all know, and there's a lot of research on this, that the more Facebook clicks you have, the more narcissistic you're likely to be. People are constantly obsessed with updating their profiles and making themselves look perfect. And in many ways, social media is feeding narcissistic selves. On the other hand, we know that social media has been a tool used by the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring to spread powerful emotions like anger and empathy. Someone could take a photograph of a young girl in Tehran being shot by security forces, and within hours, millions of people knew who she was through Facebook and other social media. So social media isn't all bad. It's just we're not very good at using it. Mostly social media has been designed for the efficient exchange of information rather than intimacy.
Yeah, there's an anecdote that you write about in the book, talking about the website Chat Roulette, which is, you know, we could do a whole show on that. It's quite the odd beast. But you know, it's the sort of thing where conceptually this could be used to really increase empathy. We're talking about talking with strangers, being connected with anybody in the world at any given time. And that is something that could really drive up empathy. But the way that people use it, it just seems to have the opposite effect.
That's right. You mentioned that Chat Roulette, which is a website started by a Russian teenager where anyone with a webcam can use it, and you press the button when you go on to the site and you immediately spun randomly into a living room anywhere from Murmansk to Minnesota, and you can talk to the person whose webcam is on about anything. The problem with Chat Roulette, which you would think would be an amazing way for us to connect with strangers from different cultures and overcome empathic and social divides, the problem with Chat Roulette is people click the next button every 2 seconds and is full of pornography. It's really quite filthy. But I think with a few tweaks, you could probably turn Chat Roulette into something pretty good. If you gave it a new name like Empathy Connect, that would help. And maybe perhaps if each time you spun yourself into someone's room online, a menu of conversational questions came up, which could be a basis for a real, genuine conversation.
Well, then aside from maybe changing the way that we're using social media, changing our habits, what are some other steps that we can take as individuals to really cultivate our inner empath?
Well, the first thing to do, I think, is to practice empathic listening. Everyone's been in situations, they're arguing with their partner, their husband or their wife, and they just thought, oh gosh, I wish I could just understand. They could just understand where I'm coming from, how I'm feeling. What are you asking for? Empathy, right? You want them to step into your shoes, if only for a moment. Now, to practice empathic listening in a relationship, you need to do two things. If you're in a tense situation arguing with someone, whether at home or in the office, you need to listen out for, firstly, what are their feelings, and secondly, what are their needs. Give them the space to articulate their feelings and needs without interrupting them, and it is extraordinary how it reduces the tension. There's a really great statistic, which is that in employee-employer disputes, in labor disputes, if both sides agree before they sit down to talk to literally repeat what the other side just said before they start speaking themselves, you reach conflict resolution 50% faster. Now that's empathic listening really working for us.
I'm talking about empathy with Roman Krznarek, philosopher, writer, and author of Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. Well, movies and books can only accomplish so much, and you write a lot about having empathy adventures. One example is this experience called Dialogue in the Dark. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is?
Now, Dialogue in the Dark is an experiential empathy immersion. It's a global network of museums that give you the experience of what it's like to be visually impaired, to be blind. And you walk in and you're given a blind stick, a cane, and a visually impaired guide takes you through an experience of total darkness for 65 minutes. And it's much more extreme than those management training sessions you can do where you put on a blindfold for 5 minutes. This is whether you have your eyes open or shut, it makes no difference. And you go into the Dialogue in the Dark and you do things like you cross a busy street which has obstacles in the way, like a badly parked motorbike. You go on to a subway station, have to click through your ticket in complete darkness. You follow the voice of your guide to the bar, and there's a blind barman, and you fumble around with your coins and notes, and you sit and have a drink, a beer or a glass of wine, whatever you like, with your guide and talk to them. And it's extraordinarily impactful. And in fact, over 7 million people have been to these Dialogue in the Dark exhibits, which have popped up as pop-up museums in over 130 cities in 30 countries. And it's a really great way of doing a bit of experiential empathy. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not something you ever forget.
What about for those of us who see maybe patterns in our own behavior where, you know, for example, I often find it very easy to empathize with strangers, but I actually have a tougher time empathizing with people with whom I've had a long history, my family or certain friends. Sometimes, you know, you build those relationships and you feel that the empathy can actually become harder as you get to know someone down the road. I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but I guess it's sort of interesting to think, you know, a stranger versus a family member versus a friend versus a coworker.
It is interesting that often it's in families where there are the biggest empathic deserts, where you may well not have spoken to your sibling for years, or people find it hard to talk to their parents or grandparents and things like that. And that's quite normal because, of course, we get into habits, into bad habits, where we fail to practice the art of conversation. So how do you break those habits, really, is the question. And it's very difficult, but I think the beginning point of that is vulnerability. By making yourself vulnerable, by talking about your own feelings, how you feel, and then giving the other person the space to express their vulnerability, you start a dance with this, which is the beginning of a conversation. It can be very difficult, but you need to let the other person speak and be open, but also do it yourself to sometimes start out the conversation, because without that, it can really go nowhere. So we need to learn to take off our masks, make ourselves vulnerable as the beginning of creating an empathic dialogue. But of course, it is really very, very difficult. Sometimes it is impossible. And in the end, you know, we often do give up. But I mean, even just a tiny example in my own life, you know, my father and I very rarely spoke very openly or emotionally with each other. You know, I've always loved him very much, but I sometimes didn't feel that close to him. And so I actually started interviewing him about his life. And I spent 7 years doing it, not continuously, but every year I'd record a bit of his life story. And I tried to make it a conversation. And after the third year, he really started opening up emotionally. We talked about my mother's death when I was 10 years old. He cried in front of me. He'd never done that before. And I did as well. And it was through that slowly building up conversation and drawing on its power that we started rekindling our relationship.
Well, Roman, you've been having this conversation about empathy. You've been, you know, traveling around, talking to many, many people. You've even got the idea for the Empathy Connect sort of chat roulette empathy site. Are you thinking about taking anything that you've been learning about this and really putting it into action through a project or anything like that?
Absolutely, I am. In fact, I think we need to create new empathic cultural institutions. And the one I'm currently working on is founding the world's first empathy museum. And in fact, it's going to launch in London in mid-2015, but it's going to be an international traveling exhibition, and I hope to bring it to the United States as well. And what will happen is you can go along and you will have empathy conversations and experiences. So you'll go there and there may well be a human library where you can borrow people for conversation. You go into another room and there's a cell phone assembly line, and you put on a sweatshop worker's overalls as if you're in a Chinese sweatshop, and you try and put together a cell phone under sweatshop labor conditions. Go into another room and there might be a brain booth that measures your personal empathy levels. And so this is going to be launching an online as well at empathymuseum.com.
Well, we'll make sure to have a link on our website. And Roman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on the program.
Roman Krznarek, philosopher, writer, founding faculty member of the School of Life in London. His latest book is Empathy, Why It Matters and How to Get It. And you'll find a link to his book as well as a link to articles and videos that explore the subject in depth at our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And Word of Mouth returns with an empathy-building experience from right here in New Hampshire. Take part in a blindfolded dinner after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. When you sit down to eat, you probably don't think too much about hand-eye coordination. But try eating without being able to see, and that changes. Sean Hurley recently ate a meal blindfolded at an event held by the New Hampshire Association for the Blind at Giuseppe's Restaurant in Meredith, and he brings us this story.
I have pretty poor vision. 2900 in my left eye, 2400 in the right. Genealogically, I'm a solid candidate for retinal detachment, macular degeneration, and cataracts. And yet, with all this action in the eye department, I never think about losing the sight I have. But as I sit down at Giuseppe's in Meredith and pull a blindfold from an envelope with my name on it, I realize this dinner in the dark might foreshadow my own future.
Thank you all for being brave enough to come here. It'll be an experience you won't forget, and that is completely true.
That's Grace Silly of the New Hampshire Association for the Blind. She helped organize this evening's dinner, and before we don our blindfolds, she introduces the guest speaker from Nashua, Randy Pierce.
In 1989, I was fresh out of the University of New Hampshire. I had a great job at Digital Equipment, and I had all of the normal sight I'd had all of my life, and I was invested in every experience I could in life. Now, unfortunately, at that point in time, I got hit by this unknown neurological disorder that took all of the vision in my right eye and half in my left eye in about 2 weeks.
Though Pierce eventually lost the little vision he had in his left eye, he continued to pursue experience.
So on July 4th, 2010, I climbed Mount Washington and we stayed at the Lake of the Clouds hut. And what was particularly powerful is that the 90 people that stay in that hut all went out to watch a sunset together.
Pierce describes the cascade of mountain ranges flowing back in feathered grays and browns, and then asks,
did any of you out there picture that?
Yes.
How can that be? You all pictured that? But you didn't see it, and I didn't see it. So how is that possible? It's because sight, right, lets you see everything that's around you now. But vision you can get not just by your eyes, not just by your sight. You can get it from your ears, from description, from your nose. It's really from your brain.
The theme of the evening, it becomes clear, is not blindness, but vision. Not what can't be seen by blind eyes, but what can be seen without them. While there are a number of blind people in attendance, most of the diners are sighted. But like John Heckman, most have been touched in some way by vision loss.
My dad had macular degeneration, so I'm going to live in his world for a few minutes.
We slide our blindfolds into place.
I know you're going to be nervous. I know that you're going to feel like the room is suddenly loud. But think about how much more you focus on your other senses when vision is taken away from you.
A server sets my plate down. The meatloaf, he tells me, is at 6 o'clock. The mashed potatoes at 11. The mixed vegetables at 2. My napkin is somewhere on the table, or floor, and I'm already stranded. But my table mates, Linda Finno and Sarah Harnden, are struggling too.
Oh my God.
What?
I can't cut this damn pizza.
Our forks and knives fumble and miss and don't dance together like they used to.
I just tried to eat my butter fish thing.
What?
The little butter container.
We have very similar experiences. We don't know how much we've eaten. We lose our water glasses, our napkins. No one can find the rolls. We grow sleepy in the darkness of our blindfolds.
Wake me up if I fall asleep.
Oh boy, Linda, don't face plant on your plate.
What's so striking is our lack of improvement. Over the course of the meal, we get worse at eating blind, not better. At some uncomfortable point, we simply stop. Remove our blindfolds. Our table is a wreck. Our meals look uneaten. During dessert, Tony Bonanno from Meredith, who's blind, and the chapter president for the National Federation of the Blind in New Hampshire, somehow finds me. He wants a reporter to attend their next meeting to help get the word out.
Any way we can get the public to understand what blindness is, it's helpful. And blindness is just a state of mind, you know?
How did you find me? I ask him. He laughs and tugs at his ears. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Labs, bulldogs, and dachshunds are among the most popular dog breeds in the United States. But is our desire for dogs of a certain pedigree harming our beloved pups?
A dachshund does not need a long back to do anything. A bulldog, what function does a bulldog serve? It can barely walk.
Word of Mouth returns with a strong argument against purebred dogs. First, this news.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. You may be surprised to learn that there's a very popular market for dogs who can't see, walk, or even keep food down. But such pups are, in fact, among the most sought-after canines of all. Modern breeding practices have brought us English bulldogs that can't breathe, golden retrievers that can't think straight, and some dogs that just keep falling over. Michael Brando is author of the book A Matter of Breeding, a biting history of pedigree dogs and how the quest for status has harmed man's best friend. And Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
You often hear people who are looking to buy a dog talk about wanting to get it from a reputable breeder, you know, from a good line, not wanting to contribute to the puppy mill problem. And I think that's viewed by many as the actions of a responsible and ethical dog owner. But you're arguing that's not the case?
Well, you should definitely stay away from puppy mills. But so-called reputable breeders, I have been working with dogs for close to 20 years, and I have met more sick dogs from so-called reputable breeders, including the progeny of Westminster champs. I mean, a lot of these dogs are in serious trouble. So it's sort of hard to know who to trust these days.
Why would that be the case? I mean, we think we're getting a good, strong dog, but what are we actually getting?
Well, the problem may be with the breed. There are certain breeds that I don't believe have good breeders, like a bulldog, for example. The problem there, and with the French bulldog and the pug, all close cousins, is actually with the breed. It's not with the breeder. I mean, these dogs are put together in a way that they're compromised in terms of how they can breathe and walk and function, and also they're horribly inbred. So, you know, many breeds I really don't think should even exist.
For example?
Bulldog, for example. When this breed was created in the 19th century, it was the first breed to have its own breed club in the 1870s in England, which is where all this started, Victorian England. It is basically a makeover, a stage version, sort of cartoon version of a former dog that actually used to do something. It used to fight bulls in a ring. It looks absolutely nothing like those dogs. People were saying in the very beginning that you should never breed a dog to look like this, to have a face that flat or to have a chest so wide that the legs are unstable and so forth. So it was a problem from day one.
Now, the seeds of this book were planted when you were actually working as a dog walker in New York City, where you got to see firsthand how our relationship with dogs is inextricably linked to our ideas about social class and social status. And I'm wondering how you saw that as a dog walker. I mean, how did that come up?
Well, I got into some very opulent households. I mean, they tend to buy purebreds, so I saw a lot of them, and they tend to buy from so-called reputable breeders, society's approved breeders, which, again, is no guarantee you're getting a good dog.
I was struck reading your book that some of the terminology that I've never thought too much about in terms of dogs, purebred, lineage, that these are terms that if we apply them to people, we would be disgusted and disturbed at even the notions of what we're talking about.
Well, exactly. We've taken some beliefs and old-fashioned values that we would no longer dare use with people. I mean, we'd call it profiling, we'd call it racism, and taken the closest species to us, the first animal we ever domesticated, and we've put it on their backs. It's almost as though we're using them to keep alive these beliefs about, elitist beliefs about blood purity, which is pure nonsense. And the eugenic notion that you have to look a certain way to have a certain character.
Well, let's talk about some of the most popular dogs right now. You mentioned bulldogs, but what are some other breeds that have really suffered because of our quest to perfect those qualities or those traits that we think we want in them?
Well, take the Dachshund. The Dachshund has been in the AKC's top 10, just like the Bulldog and the Golden, for popularity for decades, and the Dachshund has been so deformed, and increasingly so, because the tendency in the show ring and for pet breeding, which follows show ring decisions, is toward more and more extreme forms. Its back now, in relation to its dwarf legs, is so long that these animals suffer from terrible spine problems, hip problems. I think they're in the top 10 for popularity, but they're also in the top 5 for neurological problems.
I'm speaking with Michael Brando, a former New York City dog walker and author of the new book, A Matter of Breeding, A Biting History of Pedigree Dogs and How the Quest for Status Has Harmed Man's Best Friend. Well, Michael, dog breeding and selecting for certain traits does, of course, go way, way back to the beginnings of domestication of dogs. So you mentioned, I think, the 1900s. Was that a specific point that you see where breeding became especially ethically problematic?
Oh, absolutely. That's when most of the problems we're seeing in dogs began. A whole new mentality took hold of dog breeding in the 19th century. Prior to that time, you did have inbreeding. You did have crazy things done to dogs. Say court dogs could be inbred because they didn't have to be healthy. Lap dogs, they didn't have to perform any purpose. But dogs, for the most part, when they were selectively bred, were bred for behavior, for stamina,
work
intelligence.
Dogs. Yeah.
Work dogs, good old-fashioned work dogs, which are destroyed by the show ring. In the 19th century, eugenics came along, and the values shifted. Dogs started to be inbred as never before. And in fact, beyond a point, they would even need to be inbred to maintain these whimsical traits we decided we needed in these standardized commercial breeds, which came about at the same time.
Now, when you say whimsical traits, I mean, you're talking about aesthetic physical qualities that maybe look a certain way but have no function. Do you have any examples?
Well, yeah, the argument of the dog fancy is always form and function. Function was cut out of the equation the minute dogs stepped onto the stage. A dachshund does not need a long back to do anything. A bulldog, what function does a bulldog serve? It can barely walk.
There was a study that made the rounds a couple of years ago, and it was claiming that mutts aren't necessarily in better genetic shape than purebreds. It seemed to get a lot of attention, maybe more so than it deserved. Was there any truth to that claim? Are you grappling with that study at all?
That was, I think, sensationalized by the Telegraph. It was a UK study based on veterinary clinics in the UK. It was the first study that showed a small difference between purebreds and non-breeds in terms of health. Prior studies showed a much larger one. I think the Telegraph made a big deal about that. If you actually read the study in the conclusion section, you'll see that they give explanations for why there was such a small margin in this study, surprisingly. And one of them was that veterinarians tend to report as normal problems with breeds that are normal for their breeds, but that aren't normal for dogs.
Michael, it's funny. I'm listening to you, and you're making a lot of sense, but I'm thinking about all the pet owners at home who are listening to this and maybe feeling a little bit defensive. It is the sort of hard thing because people love their dogs.
Oh, it's
and it's
terrible.
And it's hard to hear that maybe they love their dogs, but even buying into an industry or buying from a breeder was a mistake, was in some way a cruel thing to do to their animals. So what do you think about the average pet owner and how they should be held responsible for these standards set by groups like the American Kennel Club or breeders?
It's a tough pill to swallow. I mean, but that's really part of the problem. I feel for them. You should love your dog. But to be in denial is not to help dogs. I mean, people become attached to breeds like they would brands or our favorite football teams. And no matter how sick they get, they become family traditions. They become personal favorites. And they mistake their individual dog for a breed. I mean, dogs are individuals.
So what do you think should be done then? I mean, it would seem that the system as it stands is unethical, but at the same time, it would be unethical, I would think, to let suffering breeds disappear or die off. What is the path forward, I suppose?
Well, suffering breeds, for one, extreme cases like the pug and the bulldog and the French bulldog, I don't see any reason to keep them. I really don't. People think they're cute. Besides that, no. Biologists I've spoken to tell me we need fewer breeds. We need a less diverse sort of catalog selection, which makes people feel special for having, you know, a particular type that's very distinct down the street, but that we need to mix it up a lot more and have fewer types based on health and based on maybe size or temperament or something like that, but not based on show ring standards for coat color and head shape and all this nonsense.
Would it be possible to reverse some of the damage that's been done in terms of breeding for selective traits that don't make sense by breeding for traits that do?
Well, sure, hopefully. I mean, there are lots of tests being done now by breed clubs for cancer, DNA tests. But one argument against that is that unless they're willing to give up this idea of blood purity and start opening their stud books and bringing in new blood, they're going to run into more problems down the line. So a lot of these DNA testing schemes are Band-Aid fixes.
Well, Michael Brando, thank you so much for telling us about a really important subject.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Brando is author of the book A Matter of Breeding, A Biting History of Pedigree Dogs and How the Quest for Status Has Harmed Man's Best Friend. You can find a link to his book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And the controversy continues on Word of Mouth. Up next, why a well-established publishing company deliberately left Israel off a map of the Middle East. That story when we return.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In an age where technology has enabled us to trace the contour of every mountain, river, and stream, and meticulously draw the borders of every country on Earth, it's easy to think of maps as unbiased documents. We forget, though, that every map is created from a particular perspective of the world. Case in point, in June of last year, Collins Bartholomew, a subset of HarperCollins, published a map that purposefully left a country blank. Israel was simply left unnamed. Rabbi Michael Cohen is a writer and a conflict resolution professor at Bennington College, and he wrote about this map for the Huffington Post. And Michael, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So this map was intended for a certain audience. Can you tell me who it was created for and what was the aim? What was the map trying to do?
It was a map for a textbook for some of the Gulf states and in trying to be culturally sensitive, which is how the publisher described it, they decided to leave Israel off the map.
And that was their entire justification to try to be culturally sensitive?
Yes, and actually in their official statement, that's actually what they had said.
And what was the reaction after the map was released and then this absence was discovered?
It was released in June, though the absence wasn't discovered till recently. And once it was discovered and it was put out there in the social media world, within 24 hours, HarperCollins was retracting, apologizing, and pulling the book, and destroying whatever copies they had of the book, actually.
And we saw some pretty strong vitriol on Amazon. Anything that resonated with you in particular?
I mean, I just found, on the one hand, I think it's very, very important to be culturally sensitive, and I really want to kind of give credit to the publisher for that. But being culturally sensitive is not, at the same time, promoting intolerance that may reside in another country. And that's the line that they crossed and that they needed to really be called on. And what's interesting, it's a British publisher, and I can't imagine that if somebody in Ireland had asked during the Troubles, please don't include England on your map for our public schools in Ireland. There is no way a British publisher would have done that, and it would have been a huge brouhaha. So the fact that they did do this, they really need to ask themselves what were their real motivations here as well. I mean, there's more to it than just that.
Well, and it's hard not to see this as especially egregious, given that it's an educational map. It's for children.
Yeah, yeah, it's an educational map. Though, as you said earlier, and as you know, many people know, maps are not necessarily always objective. They often can have a bias, though they shouldn't. You know, when we look at a map, it's really interesting, like, what's front and center? It used to be, you know, when there were maps, ancient maps of the world, Jerusalem was the center of the map.
Right.
Now when we look at maps, you know, the north is on the top, the south is on the bottom. Well, we're a globe, and some more creative maps, you know, switch it. So it's really interesting the orientation that a map will give us. You know, what's in the center? Is it Europe? Is it Asia? And so just visually, maps give us this tangible way that we kind of filter and understand even the physicality of the world, but also informs then how we tell stories and how we understand our position and the position of others. So that's just a very, very, it's almost benign, but it's got a lot of power to it, how we actually construct maps.
Do you have any other examples of how maps have been used to bolster a specific side of history in the past?
Well, clearly in the ongoing, you know, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you can look actually to both sides have been really egregious in terms of places they have omitted, lines they have omitted on each of their maps about the other. Now, that's not to say both sides also produce good maps, but there are too many examples of both sides producing maps that really have a political agenda where they leave out something to make a point.
It seems like this is such a literal way of representing the conflict in general, in which both sides almost want to erase each other out of the whole narrative, out of the whole story. What do you think happens when we adopt this mindset, when we try and just pull history to our side through something like a map?
Well, it's interesting that you use the word narrative, because one of the points that I teach at Bennington College and also at the Arava Institute that I'm affiliated with, where we bring together Israeli, Palestinian, and Jordanians, is this notion of the dual narrative, and that both sides have a narrative, and we need to understand each person's narrative to get a better understanding of the conflict. But in the telling of narratives, what both sides really need to do is not leave the other out. You can't communicate with somebody else if you're not putting them in the story, if you will. And that's exactly what happens when you play with maps, as one of many examples.
Rabbi, this seems like one of those stories that maybe was a little underreported. It seems that I hadn't heard much about it, and when I did, I said, wow, I can't believe this wasn't a bigger firestorm. Do you feel the same way?
Well, it was kept quiet for a while. It was actually The Tablet, which is an international Catholic news weekly, that actually broke the story. And once they found out about it and they broke it, it went viral very quickly, and it was shut down very, very quickly. And now why it stayed under the radar screen for so long, it's probably how many people, you know, look at books that are being published around the world and seeing what's in it and what's out of it. Someone found it, and once they saw it, wrote the story, and there was a story there.
So do you think this might be the sort of thing that's happening all the time and, you know, often we just don't notice?
Oh, I think so. I'm sure if you were to do a long study of maps in between different countries and different peoples that are in conflict, you would probably find a lot of this, not just in the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Do you think maps could actually be a really great tool to actually bring both sides together, especially in times of conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I think it could be a great, great tool in terms of bringing Israelis and Palestinians, or think of any conflicts around the world, and have people, okay, you draw your map, I'll draw my map, and then do a compare and contrast, and then see, can they create a unified map? And that would be a wonderful exercise to bring people together, because then both sides are seeing how the other side perceives the other, but then using it as a tool and a mechanism to create some kind of unified story, if you will.
Rabbi Michael Cohen is a writer, conflict resolution professor at Bennington College, and you can find a link to his article, Maps in Conflict, that's on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Michael, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you. All the best.
And we move from mapping zones of conflict to mapping fictional worlds. If you're a fan of the HBO series Game of Thrones, you probably already saw the newly released trailer for the upcoming season, and you're well aware that the world where it takes place is just as large and varied as the planet we live on today. There are continents, oceans, vast deserts, frozen wastelands, lush valleys, tropics, you name it. And as Michael Osborne of the podcast Generation Anthropocene discovered, digging into the fictional geology and geography of Game of Thrones turns out to be a surprisingly insightful exercise.
Imagining Earth millions of years ago is almost like reading a book set in a fantasy world. Our planet was once covered in ice, and before that, swamped by oceans. We envisioned supercontinents, supervolcanoes, and gargantuan creatures. We use scientific observations to reconstruct the geologic past, but if you think about it, our investigation into Earth history isn't that different from the work of science fiction. So when our producer, Miles Traer, who's also a geophysicist, decided that he wanted to apply his geology skills to Game of Thrones, there was a certain logic to his thought exercise.
So I took the main continent of the story, which is Westeros, and I decided to use little bits of information from the books, from, you know, the observations of the characters, from official maps, and a few other details to create a geologic map.
Okay, so the idea is sort of ridiculous, but Miles's map is surprisingly detailed. And scientific. Fans of the HBO TV show are familiar with the Game of Thrones landscape from the show's opening credits. And, like a lot of fantasy stories, the Game of Thrones books contain maps of the imaginary world. The inspiration for Miles's project began when he noticed that the two continents in the story, Westeros and Essos, fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. It reminded him of the way Africa and North and South America fit together, suggesting continental drift and the presence of plate tectonics. Miles then started scouring the books for additional clues. He studied the orientation of mountain ranges. He tested different map projections to calculate the distances and dimensions of the Game of Thrones world. He discovered a website called Westeros,
the Wiki of Ice and Fire,
whose authors had already tried to work out the size of the planet. Miles extrapolated information from town names and made note every time a character mentioned the rocks used to construct castles.
We know there's granite in Winterfell. We also know that there are hot springs there, so that plays into this idea of tectonics. We know there's this area called the Flint Cliffs, and I assume to interpret that literally, which I do with quite a few cities. You have Casterly Rock, where there are gold deposits. Gold is usually deposited within very specific rocks, basalts. There's a town, there are multiple towns in the south in this area known as Dorne, south of the Red Mountains. And there are three towns in particular, one of them called Sandstone. There was another one called the Salt Shore. And then there was another place called Greenstone.
Once he had a draft map of the current Game of Thrones world, the next phase was to reconstruct the geologic history. Game of Thrones is the same story, of course, where characters often remark that
winter is coming.
And the ice wall of the north is what helps protect all characters from the dreaded White Walkers. Perhaps, thought Miles, extensive glaciation played a role in shaping the Game of Thrones geomorphology. Paleoclimate turned out to be an important consideration.
There's this region called the Mountains of the Moon, and Mountains of the Moon sit in between King's Landing and the Twins. And in the Mountains of the Moon, there's this curious gap in the middle of the mountains that looks like it's been eroded flat. And really, the only thing that has that much power are ice sheets. Now, for an ice sheet to extend that far south, the planet would need to be generally colder. And that was something that I really wanted to consider, is that, yes, climate can change on this planet, too.
An impressive feature of Miles's analysis is the rigorous way in which he draws from Earth science principles. Beyond tectonics and paleoclimate, he invoked uniformitarianism, the law of superposition, paleontology, subduction zones, continental collisions, and even the formation of an oxygen-rich atmosphere. It's surprising how much trying to reconstruct the natural history of a fantasy world tells us just how much we've come to understand our own planet's history. For a geologist, a map is a hypothesis, an educated guess based on the best available information. Miles hopes that his maps will inspire others to comment and to iterate.
If you can propose a completely different formation of Westeros, I would love to hear it. I would love to know what you think. The only thing that I ask is, you know, document your principles. You know, tell me what you're assuming the way that I have, and I would love to see it. And certainly, this is It's an interpretation.
The sketches of his geologic reconstruction, along with descriptions, are now live on the Generation Anthropocene website. As the Lannisters, Baratheons, Tyrells, Wildlings, and Khaleesi wrestle for control of the crown, maybe viewers will have the chance to glean additional clues into the world of Westeros and Essos. For Generation Anthropocene, I'm Mike Osborne.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or even share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories do tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
With help from our interns,
Fiona Shea and Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.